Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today, we'll be talking about how newsrooms can protect journalists working on social media. Like it or loathe it, social media is important for journalists and newsrooms alike. It offers a way to discover audiences, find stories, and amplify content. But it comes with many drawbacks too, ranging from online abuse to invading our personal lives. This notion of a double-edged sword is the focus of a new book, The Paradox of Connection, and I'm speaking to co-author Valerie Belair-Gagnon, also the Director of Undergraduate Studies at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication, about the key message for today: put journalists first when building out social media policies. At a time when social media promises us so many connections and opportunities, what Valerie and our co-authors have found is that journalists are unplugging from platforms, and are quite relieved to do so too. So how do you build policies that safeguard journalists so they can remain on these important platforms? You'll have to stay tuned to find out. Valerie, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. Thank you ever so much for coming onto our show.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to talk a lot today about a new book that you've co-authored called The Paradox of Connection. When we talk about, you know, our hyper-connected world at the moment, you know, I do wonder, where exactly is the paradox with that? When we consider that to be, you know, a statement which might seem contradictory but yet true, where exactly is the paradox in this connected world that we all live in?
The premise of connection centers on the way that journalists can now engage with audience. They foster discussion and they create even faster, even cheaper and more accessible news online. But what we found in the book was that the reality was much more complicated. On the one end, journalists and news organizations have found very innovative ways to use social media tools, right? So, for example, the Panama Paper was a collaborative effort during the Arab Spring. The Egyptian activists and journalists were using Twitter and mobile communication to talk to each other. With that came a lot of hopes about more transparent journalism, more interconnected, collaborative, and participatory journalism. But on the other end, we found that journalists have been using strategies of connection and disconnection to mitigate the impact that social media has on their professional practice and their professional identity and their purpose. We use the term paradox to highlight this nuanced nature of online labor. With all the new forms of innovation that we have online, and the promises that digital media can bring to our own lives, we also have the material impact that it has on journalism.
So we're talking specifically today about social media in that it promises so much connection and collaboration, but conditions on those platforms cause journalists to disconnect and unplug. One reason for this is the burnout associated with constantly being online and the lack of newsroom policy support on offer. Another is online abuse. 3/4 of women journalists encounter online violence, according to research by the ICFJ, which also finds that the situation is worse for women experiencing multiple forms of discrimination. Finally, there have been notable cases of journalists fired for violating social media policies. Former AP reporter Emily Wadler was sacked in 2021 for, she claims, tweeting her political views. And former Washington Post reporter Felicia Sonmez was fired in 2022 over tweets that maligned colleagues online. The sum total is that journalists need to tread carefully online for a number of reasons. The trouble is that platforms are almost unavoidable in our profession. So you'd think that there would be a fear of missing out when journalists disconnect, but actually, they're saying it's quite the opposite.
Maybe it's a little bit more of what people have called the JOMO. It's like the joy of missing out. And, you know, we see that a lot of this has become kind of a common language around social media influencers, where you see like different people have been talking on TikTok about a lot of different ways that they can they should enjoy missing out. I think that what we're seeing here with the idea of disconnection is that people are finding that joy or that contentment of missing out on online activities by prioritizing their own self-care. So, and it allows them to be more authentic and truly do what they value.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about how journalists use social media accounts predominantly, it is through their own accounts, right? I mean, yes, there are company accounts and things, but if you want to find news stories, often you've got to use your own X account, I should say now, your own LinkedIn account, your own Instagram account. There's a lot of onus now on journalists to be individually spotlighted and active on social media platforms. So is that really what we're talking about here in terms of the constant need to be plugged into these platforms and put our lives very much, you know, center focus on these platforms?
Yeah, and that reminds me of an interview that Diana conducted for the book, and it was with a journalist in Australia. Her name was Charnel Villa, and she was a political reporter for Channel 7 in Victoria, Australia. And the vaccine rollout was happening, and meanwhile, you had a lot of groups of people online that were anti-mask, anti-vaccination. She felt the need or the purpose to be able to counter these arguments against anti-vaxxing. So she created something called Who Wants Facts. Mm-hmm. And so essentially she called her followers the besties. She also had a trend with fun facts. She received no financial incentives or support for posting, or she didn't have any organizational support for her doing that kind of work. But she really thought that it was in the public interest to do that, and also it was upholding her professional ideals of fighting against misinformation. So she kept going for a while, being like that kind of what you're talking about, like this authentic self, right? Mm-hmm. And she even said at some point that, you know, nobody believe that journalism is a 9-to-5 job and that you don't become journalists to get paid for all the work that you do, which, you know, we can we can agree to disagree here. So when she saw that the vaccine rates were higher, she decided to stop doing that kind of work because it didn't make sense for her. But she certainly did have to adopt more of the sort of online influencer persona to be able to build a following around this. So it's true that, you know, the line between the individual journalist, what they're doing in their own life versus, you know, what it is to be an impartial or objective reporter has been crossed in those online platforms.
That's really interesting, because what that really makes me want to ask is disconnecting really such a bad thing? I mean, when we talk about news avoidance, I mean, sometimes we frame that as, you know, a bad thing, but the reality is that people not engaging with the news is a reaction to being overstimulated and just being overloaded with information. Right. When we think about disconnecting from platforms, you know, maybe that's just a healthy reaction to feeling overwhelmed, overburdened with the amount of digital interaction that's required on us right now.
Right. And it is not a bad thing. It's a good thing to be able to do digital disconnection. But what is bad about it is that there isn't a recognition that with online connection, there also comes layers of disconnection. And news organizations, I think, don't recognize these different layers as part of the work. And it takes a lot of time. And some people, especially women and people of color, they are probably more at risk online of abuse.
That is actually a fact. I mean, the research on online abuse definitely does show that not only are women more at risk of online abuse, but women at the intersection, i.e. women of color, are especially at risk of online abuse. So I guess really the knock-on point is this needs to be formalized in some way in newsroom policy.
Yes, you said it needs to be not necessarily formalized in newsroom policies, but whenever you have a new technology coming up,
right,
you can ask yourself a couple of questions, right? So what would the introduction of the new digital technology or the new platform, who could it potentially impact the most, right? When you're thinking about the impact, like what kind of impact does it have? Like, is it an impact on workload? Is it an impact on digital safety, physical threats, harassment, and so on, right? And then to ask yourself, you know, what are the systems in place that should be there to support the journalists that will be most impacted at all by these new technology? And I think that in the early days of social media, this hasn't really been a question that media organization, because they were kind of so focused on this potential for engagement with social media.
Right. And I think that's really the critical point, Valerie, in that when these new shiny platforms have arrived, news organizations have been very quick to say, right, let's push resources there, let's push reporters there, without maybe considering what the toll of that would be on reporters, whether that's, you know, work-life balance or their experiences as journalists on those platforms. So really the underlying lesson here is that when inevitably the next platform emerges that demands our attention, let's think twice about what it means for the journalists who invariably roll onto them, and let's bake in some real strategies and policies which really safeguard them.
Yes, exactly.
Can you be more specific in terms of the types of questions that newsrooms should think about when it comes to not necessarily running headfirst into the next platform that's in front of us?
Yeah, I mean, I think like these are the questions I just mentioned, right? So maybe one way of thinking about it is to think about social media as an occupational hazard, right? So like any other industry, if you go in a mine, for example, you can be stuck in the mine, or many things can happen to you. And, you know, when you're on social media, similarly, there are things that happen in terms of physical, psychological, and effects on individuals, mm-hmm. Like workload or digital safety. So what kind of strategy can be built around the potential hazard that can occur to journalists when they're online? And finally, again, like, what are the systems that are in place or should be in place to support the journalists? And that's a hard question, because we're fully aware that not everybody necessarily have the resources that the BBC or the Australian Broadcasting Corporation have to support their reporters. But I think it's important to show example and to be able to have these conversations when a new technology comes. Journalist.
What it also makes me think of, Valerie, is what about the impact on our personal boundaries and our home life? Because, I mean, if we're getting mm-hmm. work notifications from our social media or on our own personal devices that we have yeah. by us 24/7, you know, next to our, in our pockets all day, next to our beds, it makes it quite hard to disconnect really in reality when maybe our phone's blowing up because something at work's happening or some news is moving. So mm-hmm. again, I mean, what I really think about is our personal boundaries that are going to be potentially infringed upon or definitely affected by, you know, whatever platform we're next going to be, arriving onto.
Yeah, and it's going to be important because here in the US, there's a lot of conversation about Gen Z and, you know, how they understand work in relationship to their life. And, you know, they wouldn't want to have their boundary to be crossed, essentially. So
yeah, right.
So I think it's important to also think about it in terms of who are we going to be able to recruit as a media organization or media house in the future, and what people are going to be willing to do for the job.
Just a quick one from me, and then we'll get back to the show. Join us on the 22nd of May at our next Digital Journalism Conference, News Wired, in London. If you're enjoying this episode, you might be interested in a session which explores how to encourage journalists to take up support in the newsroom. And we've got plenty more talks lined up on generative AI, newsletters, young audiences, and much, much more. I'll be there, and I'd love to see you there too. Head over to newswired.com for the full agenda and to grab your place today. So the lines between what is private and public are always getting blurred online, whether it's work notifications on our personal devices or what we post onto social media. Platforms like Instagram and TikTok are personality driven, meaning that journalists need to show more of their lives if they want to be relatable and succeed against influencers. It's another challenge for news organisations as they think about social media policies that are fit for purpose. Another consideration is creating a rulebook that's future-proof, because platforms chop and change so fast. It's therefore important to build the policies around broader issues like digital safety or work-life balance, rather than getting hung up on specifics of any one social media platform.
What we're looking at is not necessarily a specific platform. What we're looking at broader issues like workload, digital safety, physical threats, harassment mm-hmm. that actually are cross-cutting across platform. Some platform may have one more than the other, for example. But I think that when we're thinking about it, to go back to the idea of occupational hazard, mm-hmm. when we think about policies around the idea of occupational hazard, the concepts last longer than if you were talking about a specific thing that's happening on X, for example.
Okay, so maybe for our audience listening in who might be thinking about their own newsroom policies,
yes.
What would be one very concrete recommendation mm-hmm. that comes out of the book that they could introduce into their newsroom today or tomorrow or this week?
Yeah, one example comes from the chapter on social media policies, actually. And this one is about making sure that when media organizations are building policy, that they have people affected that by the policy that are helping building these policies, if that makes sense.
Inform them with people who have the lived experience.
Right. So having journalists in the newsroom or that are doing the kind of work online on social media involved in the policy making process.
Right. Very good suggestion. Having worked on this book for 5 years, which is a real, real big effort on you and your co-author's part, is there anything that really surprised you and you didn't expect to come out of this book? Anything that you thought, I didn't really see that coming? Anything at all that comes to mind?
It was surprising how exhausted journalists were and how much of a lack of support there was in the organization. And that was probably one of the saddest and biggest surprise that we had for the book.
Yeah. And what was the consistent thing that they were asking for when you were speaking to them?
Yeah, they were asking for having more of a collective understanding of mental health and well-being in media organizations. They felt that they were pretty much left on their own. And whenever they had issues coming up, they were saying, okay, well, go see HR. Some people even said things like, go do yoga. These were all kind of individual efforts that didn't really have a long-term impact, because when they would come back to work, they would still come up with the same issue. So it was surprising, but it was really a realization that we needed to do something about it.
Right. So the solutions on offer were pretty superficial and not really addressing the root problem.
They were superficial. They were not addressing the root problem, and they were also really individualized. So sometimes people felt that they were left alone and they didn't realize that other people in the newsroom may be experiencing the same kind of things that they were experiencing online. So it was really isolating people.
Right. And so to deal with the root problem would be to do what, Valerie?
To deal with the root problem would be for it, there's a lot. it's a very long journey. There's a lot of things that we'd have to do, but I think one of the things would be just to have a collective mindset when we're thinking about issues and harassment, and then sending someone to HR or just giving someone a break for a week may not be enough, right? So, and or just giving someone like an online video workshop may not be enough for journalists to go over all of the things that they're going on, that's going on online. So having groups of people talking about things, developing policies that are supportive of journalists in collaboration with them are some of the examples that we come up with. But also, you know, there's like a huge culture, I have been criticized by older journalists for the kind of work that we're doing, because they're like, well, you have to be thick-skinned. And, you know, we see a lot of changes around language that people are using in newsroom, like the concept of being thick-skinned. I think that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done for making sure that these places are inclusive and collaborative.
Right. Okay. And so, I mean, the place that I'll leave it is, you know, when you come to your conclusion for this book and you consider that the journalists in the workforce are feeling unsupported, they're feeling very burned out, they're feeling like they need to disconnect. Mm-hmm. What is the conclusion that you reach in the end, and what is the real recommendation that you're leaving our audience with, really? What is your final message to them?
Yeah, the final message is that we need to adopt a collective approach to mental health and well-being in journalism, and try to minimize the kind of individual approaches, or sort of like the brushing up approach that has been used a lot in media organization. And, you know, different countries will experience this differently. You know, in Europe, there's more of a culture of policy, and like Australia, there's also a lot of policy work that is done around online harassment, a little less so in the US. So different places in the world will have different approaches and how to deal with that.
Yeah. And that's pretty hard when, frankly speaking, when the next, you know, shiny object comes around. You know, the media industry is a competitive space, right, and it's under commercial strain. It's very tempting to want to run headfirst in that. But I guess the message is, listen, pause before you do so. Think about, you know, the collective need of your organization. Mm-hmm. Develop policies with them in mind, yeah, and informed by them as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Well, listen, Valerie, I thank you very much for coming on our podcast, and thank you so much for speaking to me. I really do appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
My takeaway for today is that our efforts to develop social media strategies should be equal to our efforts to develop policies to protect journalists online. Who is better served if journalists are unplugging from platforms? Not audiences, not newsrooms, and not journalists, if you consider this a barrier to them doing their jobs. One of Valerie's tips stands out to me. Invite your journalists into the process of building policies through specific internal communities. But if you have any thoughts or suggestions, I'd love to hear them. Find me on LinkedIn, Twitter/X @JPGJournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms, Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.